supplemental meeting. And we'll start off with a moment of silence for those who are not with us anymore. Thank you. Next, we have the minutes from the December 12th meeting. Any comments on those? And if not, can we have a motion to approve?
Make a motion to approve.
Second? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Would anyone in the public like to say anything? John?
Plus 5-star on their phone. I'll unmute them.
Okay. All right. Item C1, Kelly and her darn ministerial actions.
All right. Good morning, everybody. I want to thank you for your flexibility in changing this meeting with the weather. It was very helpful, so we definitely appreciate that. Unlike during the governor's executive order during the pandemic, we would have had to have a staff member here, even if everybody else was remote. So it was very much appreciated, your flexibility there. So thank you for that. This is your standard report of the benefits activity that went on in the month of January. Refunds show 38 refunds. A lot of those are the uptick in those refunds have to do with the refund liability project that Brenda and her team have been working on. They're making good headway. They've completed over 50%, which their goal was 50%, 52%, I think, end of the year. So that's a lot of work contacting old people and trying to get them to take their money when they think you're a scammer. It's difficult. But they're working through that. Retirements are down a little bit from the prior 2 years, so that's good. But I can tell you we've been receiving a ton of calls with everybody wanting new numbers because of the city raise. So we expect to see a tick up in retirement probably in April. So that's what's going on there. Anything, any questions on this report? The next item is normally where we talk about the contribution, your monthly contribution report. And because of the change in the way that the contributions are being made by the city, being a completionist, I wanted to complete that report for the next 2 months. But it didn't make any sense because there is no longer a floor and there is no longer a hiring plan and all that, so it didn't really make sense. So instead, I prepared this report for you just to let you know where we are on the city contributions. So the way this report works is the first column is the pay period. The second column is when we actually receive the contributions. The third column is what the contributions the city actually paid, and that's based on their hiring plan, based on their numbers. So you can see the first number there was a prorated pay period, so it was $3.8 million, and then it went up to about $6.5 million. And then you see kind of midway through there's a makeup because they were still paying 34.5% for those prior pay periods. So they finally thought they got caught up with the plan, and they've been paying now based on what they believe their plan is. There's a few problems with this number in addition to we think they should be paying based on our plan. But I'm working with the city on that. We also are having trouble getting reports to validate the payroll, but I think we'll solve that, so I'm not overly worried about that. The second to the last column is what our plan, the plan that the board adopted in August, what the contribution should be based on that. And then there's the shortage column, the difference between what we think the city should be paying and what they actually paid. So if you go through all of the pay periods through the last pay period that we've received, based on the difference between our plan and the city's plan, they're about $5.6 million short. There is also a number that the CFO and I based all of our numbers on, which was they would pay the budgeted contributions fully regardless of what the calculations were for fiscal 2024. We haven't received that yet. That's another $7.3 million. Jack is reviewing that and considering that. So hopefully we'll get that $7.3 million. So right now, including the extra for 24 and the shortage so far for 25, we're down almost $13 million. what I would expect going forward is hopefully we come to some resolution on the $7 million. That number shouldn't change. And then each pay period will probably fall another $400,000 to $500,000, you know, under what we think the city should be contributing, and I'll just continue to track
numbers. Kelly, I always think that sort of labels matter, and I think what you wrote here in red is true, but I don't think it's the most true thing, the most comprehensive. To me, the most comprehensive thing is that it's the amount due under the legislation.
Okay.
So it's the 2017 law that we have followed that had this post-effective requirement of us to adopt a plan. So what's here is correct, but I would label it going forward that it's in accordance with the statute, and that we're, and then if you put that however you want, that we're, you know, we did this, the board adopted a plan, but we didn't adopt the plan in just, you know, the, just out of reason we wanted to. We did it because we were legally bound to do it, and that the city has a legal obligation to pay these amounts pursuant to law. Josh, would you agree with that?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it should be labeled like that. And any time going forward in any context, we reference the adopted plan, it should be footnoted or relabeled to say that it's the mandated by the legislation.
Right.
Yeah.
And confirmed by the court.
Yeah. Yeah, and confirmed by the court, yeah.
Is the city still resisting the number, or just...
Right. They're going to, they're paying based on their plan, and that's what they're going to continue to do.
Are those numbers supported by documents that they're providing you? Like, even are the numbers that from their plan even valid from their perspective?
The biggest part of the number is based, you can tie that back to the document that they adopted, because that's the flat amount based on the UAL. The piece that I'm having trouble with, which seems just bizarre, is validating what they're saying their pensionable payroll is, and what they've done, and they show it in a spreadsheet and have highlighted it and show that they basically take what their contributions are and divide that by 6.78 and say, well, here's the pensionable payroll. No, say I'm going to give you $100, so here's the pensionable payroll. So I need to validate that, and it's not as simple as looking at a payroll register, because the city often has payroll errors, so they're making contributions for pay periods in the past. So we need to know each pay period, what was the base pay longevity and education pay for each member for this pay period to validate that. That's the report we're working on. They say they don't have a report. That doesn't make sense. They're making the deductions for the employees. They have to have a report. So Jack is working with his team on that to give me what I need there.
I think this is just further evidence to what you guys cried foul on early, is that we have to keep all of this within the scope of the legislation, because if it falls out of it, then the definition of anything is what, however they choose to define it. And we can't lose the high ground of definition, because that's the high ground from which things that were encountered our interests will occur.
There's a lot of people.
There's a lot of scar tissue, I think.
Are there any other questions on this report?
Good report.
Yeah.
It's good to do it going forward.
All right. Thank you. The next item is the standing trustee education and travel training policy. There's not the policy, I'm sorry, the list of the classes. There's two pages listed here. I would note that the annual conference for Tech First is in Austin this year at the end of March. If you want to go to that or any of the classes on here, let Sasha know. Specifically, if you're interested in going to this TechFirst conference, that's the one where they do the business meeting, and we have to submit your name to be a delegate to attend the business meeting, and then you can vote. So let us know on that. When the deadline for that submittal is, but I'll have Sasha send something out to y'all.
When is the actual date?
Oh, wait. March 31st to April 2nd. It's in Austin, so it's pretty convenient. And it's usually a good conference. That's all I have on that.
All right, we're flying.
We are flying.
All right, I'll go through the portfolio update. For the year, estimated return is 7.8% for the entire DPFP portfolio. Remember, that includes Q4 marks from last year that were recorded this year on the private side. For the public portfolio, we were up 11.7%, which makes up 75% of the portfolio. Private asset distributions in 24, we had about $80 million in distributions, which actually covered about 80% of the net benefit outflows. The custodian transition has been a key focus for staff the last few months. I got a slide in a minute, we'll go over some more details, but the transition occurred on 1-2. Looking at our investment initiatives, we have an IAC meeting a week from today here. We're going to go through the private credit pacing plan with Allborn, so they're coming in to outline kind of strategy for that portfolio and commitment expectations for 2025. And then based on the updated asset allocation and investment policy statement, we'll have initial public equity and public credit asset class structure reviews. Both of those items will filter up to the board probably in February or March for approval. And then we also plan to have the IAC appoint the private market subcommittee next week. Looking a little bit further ahead, once we get the private credit pacing plan done, we'll look at the private equity portfolio and do a pacing plan there, which is likely maybe one or two commitments for the year, focused on secondaries. And then we're looking at a possible public credit search this year and then initiating new private market investments. Any questions there? Okay, on the custodian transition, we moved from JP Morgan to BNY. As a reminder, the board approved hiring BNY at the July 11th board meeting. Since September, we've been having biweekly calls with BNY to work on the transition that converted to weekly meetings in November. We started having tri-party calls with JP Morgan and BNY and DPFP in November. We opened 35 new accounts at BNY, opened 165. Is that kind of markets across the number of accounts?
Yeah.
Okay. Global markets across seven separate accounts that totaled 165 global markets. So on January 2nd, we transferred approximately 800 securities on the separate account portfolios from JP Morgan to BNY and $94 million in cash. The key item we were looking at, which was the day after the transition, was the city contribution to make sure that came in with the new wire instructions. More concerned about kind of the city with the new wire instructions and BNY ability to receive that and book it. So that occurred successfully on the 3rd. We still have a lot more work to do on training on the new platform, reporting, accounting reports, getting performance set up, but we're on track there.
Awesome.
So hopefully we never have to do this again during all our careers here, but it's been a learning process.
When was the last time it was done?
I mean, it was like late 90s or something,
exactly.
JB Morgan.
These things don't happen frequently.
Yeah.
That's the good news.
So, I mean, a lot of our assets, as you guys know, are unique. So it's kind of getting BNY comfortable with where to put them and how to account for them. So, but we're on track.
Did you mention the treasury part?
No. Brenda, do you want
to? Sure. We've opened three new treasury accounts at BNY as well. Previously, all of our treasury operations were at Texas Capital Bank. By opening the accounts at BNY, we reduced risk of moving money from one bank to another. We reduced the amount of time that we have to do that, so kind of reduced that time that we're not in the market with that money as well. We're still in the process of getting all of the ACH, all of the checks and all of that set up and ready to go. But we should be using those accounts shortly and plan to issue the January payroll, which normally is issued on the 30, would be issued on the 31st, the last day.
Mm-hmm.
For this time, we're going to issue it a day early on the 30th just to give us some cushion if something were to happen, that we would have one more day to make sure that the members absolutely receive their payments in January.
So you might especially those of you who deal with members, you might hear something about, well, we received our pension ticket a day early.
It's an anomaly. It's not going to be.
We're doing it just because.
All right, I'll hand it over to Kyle to go through the rest of the portfolio update.
Great, thanks, Ryan. Good morning, everyone. It is that time of year when you see a lot of headlines about different banks coming out with their assumptions for 2025. So this is kind of a chart we wanted to highlight of just the variance you see across all of those different outlooks, and then also how far off they typically are. So just looking back from 2000 to 2024, and you can see kind of the range in between those bands and then where the actual results landed. For 2025, some of the numbers that have come out, a lot of them around 10%. Again, take that worth a grain of salt. But there is a high degree of variability between upside, base, and bear cases that you're seeing. I think a lot of that is due to uncertainty with inflation and rates in this coming year, federal policy changes, and then also the geopolitical environment. Some of the bear cases, just to give an idea, are as much as a 30% correction in the S&P 500. And then kind of looking back at history, just to give some context of what we've experienced in recent years and kind of long-term performance of the S&P 500, you can kind of see in the last 6 years, aside from, bad year in 2022, markets have done pretty incredibly well compared to historical norms. So that's just to give some context of where we've been and where we're going to be going. Looking back, equity market returns since the beginning of 2022, no major changes here from what we've seen in recent months. U.S. markets have done incredibly well, while, developed peers have not performed well, and emerging market peers have suffered pretty substantially.
We started looking at this chart in the early 22 downturn, looking at kind of peak to trough. Now that we're at a three-year history here, I guess it was 21, we'll probably do it rolling three-year. What we're tracking here is kind of the divergence between U.S. and U.S. tech and international markets where we're investing.
So looking at our portfolio performance, as Ryan mentioned, our total portfolio returned 7.8% year-to-date as a preliminary number. Last month, that number was for November, that number was something more like 11.3%, so a pretty significant change there. Most of that was driven by performance in the public portfolio. So in December, the total public portfolio, which is 75% of the portfolio, was down about 3%. Most of that driven by public equities. There were some headwinds, especially for value. So Boston Partners and Manulife, they were down 3.9% and 4.3% respectively. The MSCI ACWI IMI value index was down 560 basis points. So pretty significant value headwinds over the month. Walter Scott and WCM also had a disappointing end to the year. Looking at our public fixed income, I think it's important to note year-to-date, all of our managers have outperformed their respective benchmarks, and we've had pretty strong performance in the fixed income and credit side of the portfolio.
And just as a reminder, all these charts are going to look a little bit different next month because that new asset allocation went effective 1/1/25. So for the January month-end reports, we'll have it under the new asset allocation hierarchy where public credit and public credit and investment grade fixed income are split out. We'll look at it different.
We can go back to Boston Partners. I mean, I know the 3 year is good. I mean, they're 40% of the index, and then you'd think that there'd be some better downside capture in a down, and then it did, and it's worse than the index. So, what do you all think in there?
So Boston Partners, they're the most kind of deep value of our value managers. So like in the Makita reports, we'll compare them also to the value index. They have been underweight U.S. for a long time. That's where they're seeing value, is in, you know, European markets. So it's definitely been a headwind to them. If you look at their peer ranking, which we don't have here, longer term, they've done quite well, especially given that U.S. underweight. And like he said, kind of looking out 3 to 5 compared to peers, they've done well.
Okay. So are there any of these that you have sort of a yellow light on right now? Mm-hmm. Or?
I would say the small cap managers, mainly Eastern Shore, just, you know, they've caught up quite a bit this year. They did well, but since inception, the performance has been not up to the benchmark, and they're a smaller manager, so we're kind of looking at the asset base. But other than that, the four global managers we're comfortable with. Walter Scott's been disappointing, but we've been with it for a long time, and we expect that to turn around. We also moved to a performance-based fee there, so we'll not be paying as much as Walter underperforming.
And you know, one of, I thought, at least reasonable points of feedback from the whole story Wiley thing was, you know, our focus on global versus S&P. As you suggested that comment, has it affected the way you think, or, you know, or would Nikita, when you guys, you know, when you, cause like I said, I thought that was a legitimate, you know, constructive point. How have you digested that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the U.S. underweight of our portfolios that we've looked at over the years, we have a global approach to the portfolio, which means we're, you know, leaving it to our managers to decide U.S. versus global. I think it's backwards looking. He's got a good point, but going forward, you know, we're in a 15-year cycle of U.S. outperformance, so is that going to continue? And if we do make a change, it could be the worst possible time to do that. So.
I could tell you right now, I could hear Leo and Makita saying this is strategic, not tactical, and that it's for the long haul, because I've pushed back a lot about emerging allocations. And he's basically like, you know, they're kind of more disciplined about reversion to the means and opportunities and sticking to like allocations. I mean, I just think that, you know, it's more about discipline and going forward about how we look at it more strategically than tactically, I think.
I think that would be a legitimate thing. You know, Michael, I know the IAC representative would be, or the IAC would make that an agenda item for, you know, just sort of talk through that and understand where you guys are coming from, what you're thinking. And I really think it's kind of a triangle of Akita, IAC, and Ryan and your team.
Yeah.
You know, all sort of, you know, bouncing that. Because, like I said, that to me was a legitimate point. Not saying legitimate do it. I'm saying it was a versus other things that, you know, had various aspects to it. One might agree apart or disagree, but whatever. That was a legit comment.
But that also kind of begs also the pathway of comments of, you know, to quote, you know, Shadrow. God bless his soul, that he would say, let's buy S&P 500 and just close the door. I mean, so he, till day one, he was basically, you know, pounding the table about doing exactly what you're saying, or at least
at least
reviewing.
I've been an investor for 20 years. It's 15 stocks.
Yes.
You know,
I've seen Greenbrier.
Yeah.
I saw his portfolio for sure.
Yeah, I mean, every year the U.S. continues to outperform. It becomes a little bit harder to maintain our conviction in that, or for investors to maintain their conviction. You know, I think one thing we've been looking at is kind of with the EM story, I feel like more and more investors are, you know, either politically or because of the outperformance, changing allocations there, and then kind of what does that mean for capital flows into the space, which is another headwind on international EM market. So,
and then another thing, one of the reasons I was pushing so hard with about these ideas about going outside the U.S. is that in my experience being in Africa, it did not bode well. And so what I did learn about being there is that really the U.S. dollar really dictates a lot of what happens in the world, really, truly.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, it is what it is. And if you're making money, you're making money in the U.S. more so than any place else, for a lot of reasons.
All right. Well, we have the public equity structure, so we'll kind of start talking about it next month and then make it an item for us and Makita.
I like that.
So looking year to date, you know, again, year to date preliminary return at 7.8%. We had $101 million of net benefit outflows and $148 million of investment gain, ending the year just shy of the $2 billion mark.
Okay, one question on that. So that presumes or has a placeholder for the private return then, right?
No, this number includes the current marks on the private portfolio.
Okay. So privates are lagged.
Yeah, so they're usually Q3 marks. So
based upon your judgment, do you envision material ups or downs or flat to the private portfolio? Meaning that the 7.8%, yeah. You want that in some sort of loose Play-Doh that, you know, in one's mind think, oh, that could have some upside to it, that has some downside to it, or, you know, do you want it to begin to be hardened in our mind?
So for the official 2024 return from Makita, it's on a lag, which this is on a lag, so that'll be pretty close to this number.
What the actuary
does is they unlag it and they wait for the final return.
I understand.
So for Q4 marks,
in your judgment, how do you want to direct us?
I would expect the private portfolio to be pretty flat. There's obviously some moving parts in the private equity portfolio. HUP drives a lot of things, so that's going to be the biggest factor. But it's, you know, we've had some in the years where we've had down marks on HUP, we've had some up marks on other private equity portfolios. AEW doesn't tend to move a ton. We don't expect major changes there. We just heard back from Clarion, their portfolio is relatively flat valuation wise. So I would expect it to be kind of like it's been, where it's
okay,
you know,
so
stays.
But energy's done well also, so that's going to affect it at least on the positive side, not the negative side.
So privates are 25% right now?
They're at 22%.
Okay.
So that 75 doesn't include the 3%.
So just once again, to kind of frame this, because I think that these labels are important. So rounding it 12%, you know, rounded on the public portfolio. Mm-hmm. So, Michael, you know, because you're in this world, would you think that the 2024 non-lag returns for private investments would, for most peer groups that would have a functional group of investments, would be an uplift beyond the 12, flat, or dilute it down a little bit?
Not this portfolio. In general,
yeah. If we had a healthy private portfolio.
Up.
More time, Beth.
How much would you say?
A couple points, maybe.
So 15-ish, something like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that would take a 12 in public to maybe 13 or something like that?
Yeah. I don't think big swing.
I always think it's important to sort of frame that we have this salvage operation that's continuing, a multi-year salvage operation on the privates, and that we had a functional, healthy private portfolio, that our overall returns this year would be north of 12, say 13% or so.
I think a couple.
I mean, public equity was up 17%. Privates are going to lag that by a little bit. I think on the salvage analogy, hopefully with the new private markets coming in, we'll have some new replacement parts coming in to replace, you know, some of the salvage parts of the portfolio. So
I do agree that is, as it relates to our portfolio, that flat is probably the right call. I don't see much, you know, upswing there.
Peggy, you had a question?
Yeah, I just, because people are going to ask me. So, looking at these returns overall, that, you know, in November I was feeling pretty good. And we were over $2 billion, and then we had issue in December. Was that just kind of the last week of December and the yields going up, and we didn't think we're going to get rate cuts? And was that what happened?
Yeah, I mean, it was like you said, the last couple of weeks we were up quite a bit in November. We kind of tracked that $2 billion. We feel good when it starts with a two, and not as good when it starts with a one. But I mean, the public equity market was down 4% for the month. That's, you know, half of the portfolio. So if you just kind of run that through, that knocks like $45 million of gain off that Yelp chart.
Most of that was in the last week or so, like the last 10 days. It was awful.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people were taking gains for the year, plus, you know, kind of some of the longer term rate fears that came in.
Okay. Yeah, I'm recognizing, look, I mean, look nationally, statewide, because I did, 7.8% is fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's more, you know, people have a misconstrued value of pensions and performance. They look at the market and say, oh, well, we should, yeah. Our jobs, so nationally, you're between 7 and 9% nationally. Statewide, you know, 2023, I think we had it was 10.3 or whatever, that was outstanding.
Yeah.
So, not a question. I was just trying to understand this so I could explain to others exactly what was going on.
So as Ryan mentioned, we had a significant amount of private asset inflows this year as well, covering 80% of the net benefits going out the door. Since 2018, when this salvage operation kind of began in earnest, those inflows have covered 99% of all net benefit outflows, allowing us to keep our money at work in the public side of the portfolio. I would say that as we start to make new commitments in private credit and private equity down the line, you know, that is likely going to shift. We're going to have money going out the door to fund those capital calls, and this chart might not have the same relevance or play the same role in the presentation. Looking at our safety reserve, we currently have $197 million between cash and short term. This is a bit above our target of $179 million. We had taken some gains out of a couple portfolios at the end of November, being WCM, who had an incredible year. This safety reserve is also a little bit substantiated by the increased city contributions. So we've had a bit less money going out the door. It's something we're going to continue to monitor and consider those amounts. Looking at the asset allocation, as Ryan mentioned, starting next month when we look at January, this will be kind of reworked to show the new asset allocation where we've kind of combined public credit and moved a separate fixed income and cash bucket and then combined all of equities into one public equity bucket. All active managers pretty close to target at the end of the year. We rebalanced, as a reminder, emerging market debt and emerging market equity down towards their new targets. So as of 12/31, they were at or near the new targets that began 1/1/25. Any other questions on the portfolio update?
All right. Well, thank you. We got a lot of stuff for the IAC next week, and like I said, that'll be coming back to the board once we get through the IAC.
Okay,
so the hardship request is...
Right, we're going to skip the hardship request. We talked to the applicant, and she's not ready to move forward. That may come back in March.
Okay.
So we don't need to consider that either.
So we're going to go into closed session now?
I think we can cover legislative and open, unless you have any questions.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, so the session, as you all know, hopefully started this week. The battle over the speaker was settled. Representative Burroughs from Lubbock was elected. I think I was on the second ballot. What that means for us is that the expectation is that the House Pensions Committee chairmanship is likely to remain with Representative Capiglione from Terria.
Mm-hmm.
He's familiar with, you know, he's been the chairman. He was the chairman of the last session. He's familiar with our plan. Kelly and I testified in front of his committee 2 or 3 months ago, along with the city. So he's familiar with the issues involved. So we think that's a good thing. If he remains chairman, that's not that for sure. It's going to kind of shift as new members come in and people want things and so on. But that's the expectation at this point. There's been no bills filed so far on with respect to our plan or any really relevant pension bills other than there was pre-filed in November, same bill that it was from last session from Senator Hughes on ESG. Expect robust discussion on that. That has taken hold in more states since last session, so it may well get more traction this time around, not still kind of to be seen. I think the state systems are sense is that they still don't like it because they think it hampers their abilities and reduces their returns, and so we'll see where that goes. But for now, we're just sitting and monitoring, seeing what happens from the, you know, the filing perspective.
When's the deadline?
60 days after the start, so early March.
March 11th, I think. Something like that.
Legislative bills for future.
That's really it.
But Josh, you want to just sort of comment on kind of yours and Kelly's philosophy as it relates to engagement by us, non-engagement, et cetera, just relative to what's happening and what we should be thinking about and so on. That we feel like we have this affirmation from the court and that.
Yeah, I think we can just, I think because it's so integrally related to the case, I think I would prefer to discuss in close session.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was the, I know after the judge made the decision in November, there was a time frame of which there would be a response.
Yeah, we'll discuss all that in close session.
Okay.
Anything else?
Yeah.
Okay.